In Donald Trump's first week in office, he laid the groundwork for building a wall across the Mexican border and banning refugees from entering the U.S. These actions and the media coverage on them portray immigrants as coming primarily from Mexico or from the Middle East. So for this week's bonus weekend podcast, we thought we would share different stories about immigration, unconventional stories that show the true diversity of immigration in the United States. In 2012, Marnie Davis spoke with us about her book, Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition. In 2015, I talked with Paul Moses about the intense conflict between New York's Irish and Italian immigrants and their eventual partnership. And just last year, historian Tyler Anbinder looked at how New York, a city that's currently home to 3 million foreign-born residents, has defined immigration for centuries in his book, City of Dreams, the 400-year epic of immigrant New York. Enjoy. Prohibition was based on the idea that consuming alcohol was immoral and directly opposed to Christian values. But for Jews living in America during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it was hard to accept this Christian justification for a law that stood in direct opposition to not only some of their religious practices, but also their economic stability. In her new book, Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition, Marnie Davis, an assistant professor of history at Georgia State University, explains how prohibition forced Jews to choose between their culture and assimilation into mainstream American society. It's published by New York University Press, and I'm pleased to welcome Marnie Davis to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So much has been written about the Jewish immigrant experience and about the prohibition era. How did you come up with the idea of combining the two?
I came up with it when I was a graduate student. I was just in the stacks looking for a project idea, and I came upon a photograph that came out of a magazine article written about a race riot that had just taken place in Atlanta. And the caption to the photograph noted that the photographs were of two saloons, both of which were owned by people who had clearly Jewish names. Abelsky was one and Cohen was the other. And the caption to the photograph said, many of the saloons that catered to Negroes were run by immigrants, usually Jews. And so the first thing that I thought was, really, saloons? You know, when you think of Jewish entrepreneurial niches, they're usually the garment trade, the entertainment industry, and things like that. And I had just never thought about the alcohol industry as part of that. And then the second question that I asked was, what did that bring some kind of alarm for people? Why mention Jews at all? And that started me on this project.
So was there an anti-Semitic sentiment in the prohibition, the temperance movement, or an anti-immigrant sentiment?
There was certainly an anti-immigrant sentiment from the very beginning. I mean, even dating back to the earlier temperance movement in the 19th century, there was a lot of concern about both Irish immigrants and German immigrants. And Jews weren't really part of that. And in the mainstream, sort of the prohibition establishment organizations like the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Anti-Saloon League, both organizations that were very wary of and hostile to immigrants sometimes, Jews didn't really come up. You see it on other figures, people like Henry Ford, members of the Ku Klux Klan. So it's hard to say fringe figures because Ford's not a fringe figure in 1920. He is central to the culture, but it's not part of the establishment. But it definitely is part of the larger conversation about who is causing the alcohol problem in America.
And were Ford and the KKK in support of prohibition?
Oh, absolutely. Both of them were. Both of them thought that alcohol had contributed to the spiritual, moral downfall of the nation and also to its economic problems. They thought that especially Ford, he wanted to make sure that his workers weren't drinking so that they would be more productive.
But he also was anti-Semitic. He kept copies of Protocols of the Elders of Zion in his office and used to give them to visitors.
Right.
Were Jews uniquely affected by prohibition as opposed to other immigrant groups?
I wouldn't say uniquely. They certainly had their own specific, unique experience, but many other immigrant groups also felt rage in response to prohibition. I mean, Germans certainly in the years leading up to World War
I. I would imagine Italians and the French as well, because
sure.
They had traditions of having wine with their meals.
Yes, but there was something different about the Volstead Act, the national prohibition law that put the prohibition into effect. And this was Section 6 of the Volstead Act, which made sacramental wine available for the purposes of religious ritual. And this made wine available to both Catholics and Jews. But because of the way that Jews consume wine, which is in the home around the dinner table, it turned out that wine was sort of dissipating into the community, and it became very easy to get.
Although Robert Mondavi told me that his family got into the wine business as suppliers to Italian immigrants of wine grapes during Prohibition.
Oh, sure. And George Latour in California, a French immigrant, also got involved in sacramental wine. But what happened because of Section 6 was that there was a sort of an interweaving of concerns about alcohol and concerns about the role that Jews played in the American economy. It sort of hit all of the alarm bells for some.
But for people who in the temperance movement, how was the story of Jesus turning water into wine explained?
Variously. Some had said, well, he did this, but if he had known about the real effects, if he had like the scientific knowledge that we have today, he never would have done that. But others claimed that, in fact, what he had done was turned water into pure wine, which was unfermented grape juice. And prohibitionists, and especially prohibitionists who were motivated by Protestant theology, spent a lot of time in doing exegetical work, trying to figure out how it was exactly, or to explain how what Jesus was doing was not making fermented wine, but instead making unfermented wine. And Jews, of course, responded by saying that's utterly ridiculous.
Well, alcohol played two different roles within the Jewish community. On the one hand, as you pointed out, some were in the business of owning saloons and the like, small business people. Others were actually in the business of manufacturing it. And then there was a whole religious side of it, drinking wine during certain religious rituals. Within the Jewish community, Jews were also forbidden from consuming wine that was made or even handled by non-Jews.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that is the strictest law regarding kosher wine, that kosher wine can only be produced by a Jew who keeps kosher from the moment of the picking of the grapes till the moment that it is poured into the chalice or the glass. There is actually a long tradition of that rule being broken or loopholes being sought for Jews who sought integration into their larger communities. And I mean, this dates back well before the American scene. It dates back even to, you know, the Eastern Europe, and you could even find evidence of it in the Middle East. But it's worth suggesting that Jews were, if Jews who were keeping kosher in other ways, not mixing milk and meat, were drinking wine in order to be convivial with their neighbors.
Well, Reform Judaism was growing in popularity in the late 19th century.
Yes, precisely.
Reform Jews, did they have different attitudes about wine than Orthodox Jews?
Well, I think that they had sort of multiple attitudes. Certainly Isaac Mayer Wise, who was probably the most important leader of the American Reform Jewish movement. He created most of the establishment institutions from his pulpit in Cincinnati in the late 19th century. And he simultaneously encouraged American Jews to abandon some of the rules of kashrut, of keeping kosher, in order to become more acculturated in their American environment. At the same time, when a man named Benjamin Dreyfus, who established a general winery in Anaheim, California, started to make kosher wine, Wise celebrated that. And he said, this is good for the economics of our community, and it's also good for the spiritual connection to the history of the Jewish people. So they kind of had it both ways a little bit.
My guest is Marnie Davis, assistant professor of history at Georgia State University. Her book, Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition. But Rabbi Wise had another, he was involved in another dispute. The temperance movement was largely run by women, Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Indeed.
And you say that in 1893, a group called the National Council of Jewish Women was founded largely because Jewish women, too, wanted the chance to participate in reform organizations like the WCTU. And then Rabbi Wise wrote in 1874, any Jewish lady would consider it sacrilege and blasphemy to abuse prayer and benediction for purpose of public demonstrations. There were no whiskey Amazons in the tents of Israel.
Yes, that's true.
And I no should... feminist, this rabbi. No,
certainly not. And most Reform rabbis in the 19th century were not. They were sort of aghast at, not sort of aghast, they were absolutely aghast at the prospect of women, especially women praying in public, which is what happened during the Women's Christian Temperance Union was founded after the Women's Crusade in 1873 and 1874. And this was a movement of grassroots activism where these women would go into saloons and sit in front of saloons and pray until the saloon keeper promised to never sell another drop of alcohol. And Reform rabbis just found this utterly appalling and saw this as a transgression of the proper gendered behavior of women, and Jewish women, they said, would never do such a thing.
But it seems to me that we have two different things pulling at the Jewish community at this time. On the one hand, there's business and there's tradition, and on the other hand, there's the desire to assimilate and be like everybody else.
Precisely. They managed, in the 19th century, American Jews, and especially those Reform Jews who spoke out against prohibition, they found a way to make claims about their connection to alcohol, their attachments to alcohol, that laid claim to both, that said, we are Jewish. We have this longstanding connection to alcohol, both in terms of consuming it and also in terms of producing it and selling it. But the way that we produce it and the way that we consume it actually makes us better Americans because we consume it. They claimed that Jewish consumption of alcohol was sort of naturally moderate as opposed to saloon goers of other ethnic groups. It seems to me that that's not actually true, the claims that they were making, that it was much more complicated than that. But those are the claims they were making.
But was alcoholism less of a problem within the Jewish community?
Records suggest that it was. And, I mean, both public health records at the time and anecdotal evidence from people who I've talked to, there seems to be a general consensus that Jews drink less than do other people, members of other ethnic groups.
Maybe it's because kosher wines are so sweet. we have Rabbi Dov Ber Manashevitz making wines from indigenous American varietals like Concord grapes, the same stuff that we get grape jelly from.
Yes.
And it's very sweet.
Very sweet.
So they were less interested in doing something that would be like a Bordeaux or a Burgundy.
But yes, then that's true. But so few Americans drank wine in the 19th century. It really was a consumption habit of the elite. Americans drank beer and they drank whiskey, and they drank a lot of whiskey.
But you also point out that record numbers of Jewish-owned saloons also opened in the late 19th century. So Jews started to be seen as moral and economic threats to the American way of life?
Sure. And this wasn't only in regards to alcohol. There was a growing sense amongst native-born Americans, especially native-born American Protestants, that immigrants in general, but Jews in particular, were playing a nefarious role in the American economy, that especially, I mean, economic anti-Semitism certainly predates the American scene. There is a long-standing tradition that comes out of Europe that Jews play a parasitic role in any economy that they participate in. And so that idea makes its way to the United States.
Well, why were so many Jews involved in various alcoholic pursuits? We have some of the great whiskey producers being Jewish families. Even today, the Bronfmans they're Canadian, but
yes.
Still.
Yeah, sure. There's, I think, a combination of reasons. Some of it is that there is this longstanding connection between Jews as a religious community and alcohol, in which there isn't any taboo against alcohol the way that there is in some denominations of Protestantism, for instance. Second, there is a tradition of participating in the alcohol industry in Europe, dating back to the Middle East, but certainly in Eastern Europe, Jews were known to be among the tavern keepers and the distillers and the brewers, and so they brought both that experience with them and also just the sense that that was an available opportunity for them. And third, there's just the issue of chain migration, that one person shows up in the industry, turns out to be one where there's fantastic opportunity, so he brings over his brother and his cousin, and then next thing you know, in cities like Louisville and Cincinnati, there are pretty vocal, large and visible communities of Jewish wholesalers of whiskey and so on.
You point out that because alcoholic beverages were available in synagogues at the end of the service, people with non-Jewish last names joined synagogues in large numbers in the 20s?
Yes. Though it's also worth pointing out that Jews were also beginning to join congregations in larger numbers. There was a record of one congregation in Oakland, California, that before Prohibition that had been about 50 families. And by 1921, this is 500 families were now members of this congregation, and nobody for a second thought that they were there because they had found their Jewish roots. They were there for the sacramental wine.
On the other hand, there were some Jewish organizations that urged Jews to use grape juice instead of wine at Passover.
Yes.
During the Prohibition years. And some of the most famous Prohibition agents, like Izzy Einstein and Mo Smith, were busting the bootleggers.
They were, and flamboyantly, enthusiastically so. I mean, Izzy Einstein was one of the more famous and self-promoting, sort of happily self-promoting of the Prohibition agents, to such a degree that he ended up getting fired for it. But he was a character, I guess you would say, and he used that character, that he used his resemblance to sort of a Jewish character, stereotypically Jewish character, to his advantage. And Americans were delighted to read about it.
On the other hand, there were Jewish gangsters like Meyer Lansky who made alliances with mobsters like Lucky Luciano.
Sure.
To bring booze into America during
right.
Prohibition.
So Jews were absolutely on all sides. I mean, much like other Americans, Jews were on all sides of this argument. There were Jews who participated in its illegal purveyance, much like others did. There were Jews who fought to make it less available, much like other Jews did, much like other Americans did. So it's really the conflict, the tensions between Jews within the Jewish community in the United States over Prohibition. There are some things about it that are unique to the Jewish experience, but in other ways it shows just how American Jews had become.
Well, you're right that Jews stayed in place on the issue while American culture changed around them, and they eventually found themselves not only on the losing side of the national debate, but also distrusted, even vilified, for ever having been on the side of liquor. Did that distrust have lasting consequences after repeal?
Certainly, the 1930s were a period of heightened anti-Semitism in America.
Well, there was also the emergence of Hitler in Germany.
Right, and a movement of allied fascists and anti-Semites in the United States. But also there was a growth of social anti-Semitism in America, where Jews were kept out of country clubs and away from participating in colleges, from enrolling in particular colleges. So all of that was happening simultaneously. But it seemed to me that one of the things that happened, although anti-Semitism was on the rise in the 1930s, that Prohibition, the end of Prohibition, the failure, the massive, unequivocal failure of Prohibition to do away with the problems that alcohol had caused, really makes alcohol less of an issue of anxiety in America. And so though anti-Semitism goes away, this image of the nefarious Jewish alcohol entrepreneur does dissipate in American culture, because alcohol is no longer seen as the problem that it once was.
Marnie Davis is assistant professor of history at Georgia State University. Her book, Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition, is published by NYU Press. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today to talk about this little known aspect of American history.
I'm really glad to be here. Thanks.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the late 19th and early 20th century, what has been called a race war simmered, then boiled over in the streets, docks, and churches of New York City. Paul Moses' new book, An Unlikely Union, The Love-Hate Story of New York's Irish and Italians, recounts the rivalry between Irish and Italian immigrants that helped shape New York City and national politics through competition as well as a mutual desire to be accepted into American society. In telling a story of revolutions in faraway lands, gangs, mobs, bombing, sabotage, social movements, and ultimately romance, Mr. Moses gives us a glimpse into a past that is oddly similar to modern times, an argument about immigration. It's published by New York University Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Paul Moses to our show.
Hello. Good to be with you, Leonard.
Can you give us an idea of what New York was like in the late 1800s?
Well, it was changing rapidly. We've gone through some very rapid immigration changes while that was going on in that period, too. So Italian and also Eastern European Jews were coming in very large numbers, and that was upsetting the status quo in some ways.
The Irish, in some cases, in other cities, were quarantined, weren't they?
Well, certainly the Irish, when they came in large numbers earlier in the 19th century, went through some very serious discrimination that they encountered.
So did they have to deal with similar obstacles when they arrived?
Well, the Irish and the Italians had one similarity in that they were both rural people and very, very poor. And so that meant they did the same kinds of work, for example. So there's that adjustment into an urban environment, first of all, but they had a struggle to be accepted.
But since the Italians came later, the Irish were more established politically by that time.
That's right. 1880 was the year the first Irish Catholic mayor of New York was elected, William R. Grace. And that's also the year, looking back, in which the Italian migration really starts to become intense.
Your subtitle is The Love-Hate Story of New York's Irish and Italians, but not the Eastern European Jews?
No, I focused on the Irish-Italian relationship in this book, and I deal with the with other groups, major groups like the Jews, only to the extent they are involved in that Irish-Italian relationship, which they are certainly by the 20th century. The Jews kind of become the swing vote in New York politics between the Irish and the Italians.
Now, the Irish came here because of the famine and other things. Mm-hmm. Why were Italians immigrating to the U.S. in large numbers?
You know, they succeeded in uniting their country, which was a great feat in the 19th century. And from the perspective of Southern Italians, things only got worse, the taxes, the oppression. And they just got so poor that the migration kicked off into high gear.
Of course, they weren't coming to New York City as we know it because New York City wasn't consolidated until 1898.
That's right. So there's a big migration to Brooklyn starting on Union Street, you know, off the waterfront there. And there's a big migration to Lower Manhattan and up to East Harlem, too.
Did they go to similar neighborhoods, adjacent neighborhoods?
You know, yes. Well, I mean, that's where some of the conflict comes in. So the Italians start coming into what was called the Five Points there, the Lower East Side, and that was all Irish.
Now, why was there a problem? After all, we're talking about people who are Catholics.
Yeah.
They share a religion.
Yes. I like to say they were two people divided by the same religion. It became one of the battlegrounds between the two. Although I think it originates more in economic conflict, so Italians start coming over and are willing to work for longer hours and less pay than Irish laborers were. So in industry after industry, it becomes a battleground.
Now, the Irish laborers had been willing to work for less pay than the previous inhabitants of New York. So we were just seeing a cycle repeated.
Yes.
Did people not remember that?
Well, I guess not. The Irish were very good about organizing unions. Business used Italian workers as strike breakers. So there's kind of a built-in animosity there that I think spilled over into other arenas.
The Catholic Irish had struggled for social acceptance in a largely Protestant country. In 1880, they had just elected their first mayor, William Grace. How did the Italians threaten their social status?
I think part of the problem was the Irish were trying to prove themselves in a Protestant society. When Grace was elected, the Times had an editorial beforehand saying not to vote for him because New York is, quote, an American Protestant city. So that's the world the Irish are trying to be accepted into. And the Italians, with their practices that were kind of looked at in Protestant America as being superstitious, and they were very poor. They didn't speak English. The Irish sort of had to bring them into the family, so to speak, but yet there were these conflicts too.
Well, that kind of editorial would be unthinkable in today's New York Times, but there's a lot of that kind of thing throughout your book, plenty of examples of racism and bigotry coming from very public figures. Italians are often accused of being having loose morals, and they're compared to beasts. And Teddy Roosevelt writes a letter to his sister that's kind of shocking.
It was after the lynching of those Italians in New Orleans who had been suspect and then cleared in the murder of the police chief. And he basically says in this letter that he approves.
He said that that some Dago diplomats he met while dining out were upset over the lynching. And he said, personally, I think it's a rather good thing, and I told him so.
Yes, that's a great Teddy Roosevelt. That's right.
Well, on the other hand, we are hearing all sorts of talk about not talking Mexican today.
Well, you can't miss the parallels. It's unbelievable. This attempt to take an immigrant group and make them morally unfit to be Americans, it happened back then to the Italians and the Irish and the Jews, and it's happening now to Mexicans and others.
I remember reading that somebody in Congress said that the Italians and the Jews were all mentally deficient because when they were given IQ tests, they scored poorly. Of course, they were given the IQ tests in English.
That's right. And actually, it was Margaret Mead who actually pointed that out. A lot of academic scholars endorsed this idea of the Italians and others being genetically inferior and thus not ready to be Americans.
What was the padrones system?
Yeah, these were labor brokers, and so Italians would come to these offices on Mott Street and get placed with jobs, but they often exploited the workers, put them in like company towns and situations like that. So they were not friends to the workers, and it was something that needed to be broken up. They were partly responsible for the very low wages that the Italian workers would accept, for example.
And were there Irish companies, or were they these Italians just competing with Irish workers?
These were fellow Italians who came here, got themselves established, and were brokering them to railroads. And business liked the flow of cheap labor.
Now, I mentioned that one of the slur words was Dago. Where does that come from?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It was actually a term for the Spanish, from Diego. That's right. And the same thing with the term Guinea was actually a term that referred to the coin used to buy and sell African slaves. So
So Italians were somehow linked to Africans
in that way, sure.
Because they were darker skinned in many cases, Mediterranean people.
I think that's part of it, and scholarly opinion had this hierarchy of racial groups that depended on the size and shape of the skull and all this stuff, and so Italians were ranked very low. As an Italian American, half Italian, it's humbling to read how my grandparents' generation was looked upon.
Paul Moses' book is An Unlikely Union, The Love-Hate Story of New York's Irish and Italians. But anybody who's been to Italy knows that there are many Italies. Right. So what were we seeing here with these Italian immigrants? Were the immigrants from the north, did they look down on the southern Italians the way they often do in Italy?
I think there's a bit of that here in New York, and most of the immigrants who came in later on, early on they were more from the north, but after 1880 it was mostly from the south. And actually these kind of racial hierarchies that the academics would draw up placed northern Italians in a different category from southern Italians. So yes, there is that split, and I think you see it in the church, too. I think a priest from the north might not really understand the southern Italian ways as well. So in fact, one Irish observer said that, they don't get along any better than the English and the Irish. So there was that observation.
They speak different dialects of Italian.
Sure.
Now, we're talking about conflicts. How serious were these conflicts? Did they lead to physical violence?
Yeah, a great deal. And just one example, there were so many fights between Irish and Italian crews of workers setting down tracks for the trolleys in Brooklyn that the Brooklyn Eagle ran an editorial headline, "Can't They Be Separated?" It went much deeper than I heard about these things before I wrote the book, but in researching it, it's really all over the old newspapers.
On the other hand, I imagine that some people formed alliances.
There are alliances. I talk about a particular gangster who became a labor leader, Paul Vaccarelli, a.k.a. Paul Kelly, and a great figure of New York politics from the 19th century, Big Tim Sullivan. And they certainly had an alliance. They were shrewd, and they knew how to help each other.
And didn't Al Capone marry an Irish girl?
Al Capone had an Irish wife, and there's a chapter in the book which talks about how the he was part of a shootout in which the leadership of the Irish mob in Brooklyn was wiped out in 1925.
Now, we mentioned we're talking about Catholics and Catholics, but they approached the religion differently. You mentioned that the Italians and Irish have different ways of practicing their faith. The Irish a little quieter than Italians?
Definitely more austere, more focused on the Mass, on the sacraments, on obedience to the priests and the bishops, whereas the Italians were more focused on the saints and Mary and not as connected to the institutional church, maybe even a little anti-clerical because of their history of having to conquer the papal states from the Pope in order to become a single nation. And the Irish priests pick up on that attitude, and there are a lot of battles within the church. I should say eventually the church becomes a unifying force because all the Irish and Italians, so many married each other after World War II.
But then the church today is a very strong proponent for immigration. What was its position on immigration then?
It definitely was then, too. That's a very consistent thing through American history is the church's position on that. In fact, I think if you asked a bishop or a pastor back then, they were trying to Americanize the Italians maybe a little quicker than some of them wanted to.
Well, I think that maybe the church itself may be more pro-immigration, but I suspect that Italian-Americans and Irish-Americans, like every other kind of hyphenated Americans these days, have very mixed feelings about immigration because now the American part has kind of taken over.
Right, and I actually mentioned that near the end of the book. If you look at polls on immigration, the white Catholics are maybe a little bit more pro-immigrant than the average white respondent, but not significantly.
There are many Catholics from Latin America in the country now. Have there been similar divides in the church in recent times?
I think if you talk to Latin American leaders within the church, you go back enough, you will hear some stories of division. I don't think it was as systematic as what happened in the 19th century, but there are very few Latino bishops, and that's probably something that the church will be working on in the future with a pope from Latin America.
Although the first Italian American to head a Roman Catholic diocese in New York State, he reminded me to some degree of the current pope because he was a liberal. He wrote a pastoral letter titled "Sexuality, God's Gift."
That's right. Did you know Bishop McGovero? Yes, he was, I believe, appointed in 1968, so it took that long before there was a bishop to head a diocese.
Because the church was mostly controlled by Irish Americans, and even now most of the cardinals of New York have been of Irish descent.
Yeah, no, every archbishop of New York has been of Irish descent, except for one very early on who was French.
Was there any pushback from the Italians due to the unfair treatment that they were receiving?
Oh, yeah. It went all the way to the Vatican in the 19th century. The Vatican jumped in. Pope Leo, who, of course, was Italian, as many popes were, issued an encyclical aimed at the American bishops to deal with it. And there were some scathing documents going back and forth.
And then there's the whole matter of crime, because there were, as often the case with immigrant groups, many wind up engaging in criminal activity.
To me, that was one of the most interesting parts of the book, was that the police-community relations between the largely Irish department and the Italian community was very much like police-minority relations that we have in New York now. And there was a piece in the Times after those two police officers were tragically killed. One was Latino and one was Chinese, if you remember that terrible shooting. And the Times said that referred to the Irish and the Italian roots of the NYPD. And it's true that Italians are very much a part of the NYPD. But it took a while for the Italians to get even a toehold in the NYPD.
Although they did wind up playing a major role in American New York State politics. And one of New York's most beloved mayors was Fiorello LaGuardia, followed by, if I remember correctly, by Paul O'Dwyer.
William O'Dwyer.
Bill O'Dwyer.
And it was interesting because in LaGuardia's last victory, he won three times. He ran against Bill O'Dwyer, who was born in Ireland, police officer, Brooklyn DA. And strangely enough, in that election, 1941, the Italian vote went to O'Dwyer. And to me, that's a sign that the two groups were starting to come together, if it's possible for that to happen.
And then we had Impellitteri.
There was a year there where the three major candidates were all born in Italy. Yeah.
Now, this extends to other areas. For example, there was a rivalry between Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did that really have some ethnic tension, or was that just good marketing?
No, I draw actually the opposite conclusion from it because, yes, there's a lot of marketing in that rivalry. There was a supposed feud about who was the best male vocalist in the 40s, early 40s. And it was the talk of the town, or the country, really.
It was Fred Astaire, wasn't it?
Maybe so. But on the charts, they were the two top singers. And what was interesting about it to me, and this was really big, like Wins Radio ran a contest, send in your ballot. They got 1 million ballots, often written down in very comical ways. But what it said, what was interesting to me was that if you were Irish, it was possible to be for Sinatra and vice versa. And so in that period in the 40s, we're starting to see some of the social boundaries blur. And it's preparing for what happened after World War II, where the two intermarry on a large scale.
And assimilation changes things. People are less likely to be culturally Irish or culturally Italian after a century of living.
Oh, yeah.
And is it different in New York than it is in other parts of the country? You point out that nationally, most Irish Americans are Protestants. I was surprised by that.
I was, too, when I came upon that. But that's true. I wouldn't say that's the case in New York City, but nationally it is. I think it depends on how many of a group are in a place, because if there's only a few Italian Americans, they're not going to kind of stick to their own for as long. They're going to mix with the others more quickly. But if there's a large community and everybody lives in the same neighborhood and there's kind of a lot of institutions built around kind of ethnicity, I think it takes a little bit longer.
Well, we also have traditional neighborhoods that have all broken down. For example, Little Italy. The only thing Italian about it is the names of the restaurants. The people who live upstairs are mostly Chinese. The people in the kitchens are mostly Mexicans.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of the story as people moved out of their ethnic enclaves and went to the more residential areas of the city or to the suburbs. They did kind of start afresh and mix with each other. And if they were mingling as equals, if they had, gotten similar kinds of work, it became very easy for the social boundaries to fall away.
So is the tension completely gone?
I'd say nowadays it's mostly a matter of joking. Every year around St. Patrick's Day, St. Joseph's Day, big Italian feast, there's always joking about it. But and there's people around who have been around long enough to remember some of the tensions better. And whenever I talk to a group, people always have stories about whose family didn't want to meet whose boyfriend and who was resentful about him. That stuff, but it's faded away. It's mostly in fun.
Paul Moses is professor of journalism at Brooklyn College, CUNY, and a former city editor at Newsday, where he was lead writer for a team that won the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is called An Unlikely Union, The Love-Hate Story of New York's Irish and Italians, published by New York University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
WNYC has been a magnet for people seeking a new start since 1625, when 30 employees of the Dutch West India Company arrived on the island, then dug out shelters and began to build a new colony. In the nearly 400 years since, millions have followed. More immigrants have come into the United States through New York City than through all of the country's other entry points combined. Tyler Anbinder tells the story of New York City's immigration in City of Dreams, which Philip Roth has called a necessary book for any reader, New Yorker or not, curious to know the astonishing sweep of transforming migrations that have made the city the polyglot extravaganza that it is. Tyler Anbinder is a professor of history at George Washington University and author of two previous books. This one is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
And you must have been pleased to receive that kind of praise from Philip Roth, because I imagine you've been working on this book for some time. It's over 700 pages long with more than 100 pages of footnotes. You're at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. What got you interested in the story of New York?
Well, I'm originally from New York. I lived here from the time I was a small child, 1967, up through 1990 when I finished graduate school. So I grew up in New York, and the city has always fascinated me.
Immigration has been a contentious subject during this current presidential campaign. Donald Trump has suggested the United States should deport anyone who's living here illegally. He has proposed building a wall on our border with Mexico, prohibiting Muslims from entering the country. Didn't you discover that this sort of anti-immigrant rhetoric dates back almost to the very beginning?
Just like immigration is a common theme in American history, anti-immigrant sentiment is something that's always been an undercurrent as well. So you find, you know, if you go all the way back to the Dutch were afraid of English immigrants and didn't want them to come. The English didn't like the Irish and so on and so forth all the way to today. So while New York has always been an especially accepting place for immigrants, there's been this undercurrent of nativism as well.
And what about the Native Americans who were here before the Dutch?
They're an interesting story. You know, there's the kind of mythic story of the Indians selling Manhattan to the Dutch, which is not really what happened.
$24 in trinkets.
Right. It was more of a mutual understanding of co-occupation of Manhattan Island, and the Indians didn't have the same concept of land ownership that we had. But the Dutch thought they had bought the island and were proud of it.
And you quote an early colonist as saying that the American Indians were to be avoided because they're very vengeful, resembling Italians. Had any Italians come to the area at that time?
No, but of course the Dutch had experience with Italians in Europe, and so that was their sense of Italian. Already at that point, Italians were known for vendettas, and that would be something that then Italian immigrants would be known for later.
Now, didn't the Dutch and the indigenous people coexist fairly peacefully until the 1640s, when the Dutch demanded that the Indians pay taxes?
They did. They Manhattan was a big place. The number of Dutch settlers was tiny, you know, 100, 200 for most of the first couple of decades, and they were all settled at the very bottom of Manhattan Island. So yeah, they got along fine until suffering from financial pressures. One of the governors of New Amsterdam decided he was going to tax the Indians, and that was the downfall of the good relations.
And actually massacred them if they objected.
Yes, his plan was if they didn't pay the taxes, to kill them and set an example for the other Native Americans, and that didn't go well either.
And then there's Peter Stuyvesant, who wanted to prevent Jews, Lutherans, Catholics, and Quakers from entering New Amsterdam. What happened?
Well, it's kind of ironic. So the Dutch who run New Amsterdam, the company that runs New Amsterdam back from the Netherlands, they are very interested in having anybody be allowed to settle in New Amsterdam. But Stuyvesant, who's the first governor who really does a good job of running the colony, he does not believe in any heterogeneity at all. He wants everyone to be Dutch Reform, and anyone who's, you know, even a Lutheran was considered too exotic for Stuyvesant.
But then the directors of the Dutch West Indies Company included three Lutherans. So they said, no, you can't exclude Lutherans. He also, Peter Stuyvesant, expressed some of the most awful anti-Semitic remarks when he tried to exclude these 24 Jewish immigrants from Brazil. There already were Jews here, but they had Dutch passports. He said that Jews were a repugnant race and usurers, and he wouldn't also that they were deceitful, such hateful enemies and blasphemers of the name of Christ. So they shouldn't be allowed to further infect and trouble this new colony. But he was told that he better let them in.
He was told that he needed to let them in. But what Stuyvesant was able to do, Stuyvesant had a lot of autonomy because even though his bosses would send him directions, it took 2 months for those directions to make it across the Atlantic and 2 months for any word of him not following the directions to get back to his bosses. So he pretty much had a free hand, and he used it to... So even though he was forced to let the Jews stay, he gave them no rights and no privileges and didn't even let them practice their religion publicly.
When did English immigrants start to arrive, and how long was it before the English population surpassed the Dutch?
Well, the English were in the vicinity ever since the Dutch were here, starting in Massachusetts and then slowly moving down into Connecticut and then into eastern Long Island and then slowly towards central Long Island. And the English were always seen as a menace looming in the distance. And so by the mid-1600s, the number of English is starting to alarm Stuyvesant.
And there was a Treaty of Hartford that in which areas were divvied up.
Correct. In the Treaty of Hartford, the was not a good deal for the Dutch, but the Dutch had so little power in New England and North America that they had really no choice. So by the Treaty of New England, the Dutch give up most of Long Island, and that further brings the English closer to New York.
The Dutch gave up control of the city to the British in 1664, but then regained control in 1672 and lost it again in 1674. Did that back and forth create animosity between the Dutch and the British populations, or did they tend to get along?
It didn't create so much animosity between the Dutch and English New Yorkers as it did between the Dutch New Yorkers and the Dutch government and the English New Yorkers and the English government, each of which thought they were being let down. And especially when the Dutch came and took New Amsterdam back over, the Dutch celebrated. And then when the English took it over again, those Dutch who celebrated a little too much got in trouble.
And then something that we've also seen along throughout the history of the United States, the British passed laws that made English the colony's official language.
Yes.
If you didn't speak English, you were in trouble?
It's not that you were in trouble, but you were required to use English in the courts, in public documents and legal documents. The Dutch stuck very tenaciously to their language, and this was an effort to get them to stop using it.
You note that by 1692, 39 different languages were being spoken in the city.
It was really a Tower of Babel already, and even at that early point, known throughout the Western world as this particular place where people from all over the world settled.
Should we be surprised that by 1664, 40 years after the first Dutch colonists arrived, slaves comprised 20% of New York City's population?
Yes and no. I mean, we don't think of New York City as a place that has the kind of economy that would lend itself to slavery. There's no tobacco. There's no cotton. And yet, slaves are an important part of the economy. They're hired already at that early stage, you know, to do the work that other people don't want to do, building the fortifications and also doing some of the agricultural work.
And were they coming directly from Africa, or were they being brought up from the South?
They're being brought mostly from the Caribbean. So New York becomes a real trading hub for the English, for trade between the Caribbean and New England. And so a lot of the trade comes through here, and part of that trade is in slaves.
My guest is Tyler Anbinder. His book, City of Dreams, a 400-year epic history of immigrant New York. Didn't immigrants have different ethnic from different ethnic groups establish separate neighborhoods and specialize in different trades or businesses as far back as the 1600s?
Yeah, even in the late 1600s, you have parts of when everybody who lives in New York lives below Wall Street. Already then you have an English neighborhood and a Dutch neighborhood. You even have a kind of a Jewish neighborhood near the Jewish synagogue. So already by that point, they are specializing.
And then they're specializing in their trades.
Yes. The Dutch in particular in the building trades, and they did still the the majority of the building of the city, whereas the English were in particular merchants, and lots of English merchants sent junior partners to be stationed in New York and supervise their North American trade.
Did people belonging to different ethnic groups simply gravitate towards certain kinds of jobs, or were there laws about who could do what?
There were not laws, for the most part, about who could do what. There are some exceptions, some things Jews are banned from doing in the early period. But other than that, it's more kind of social networking. So if your father or your relatives or your friends are, say, carpenters, it's much easier to break into the carpenter's trade than otherwise.
I've always been curious about the use of landfill to expand the southern part of Manhattan. The island was big enough to accommodate anybody who came. Why did they feel they had to do landfill?
Well, even back in the 1600s, New Yorkers were great real estate speculators. And they knew, looking at the island, that everybody wanted to be in the prime locations, and people didn't. And if you were a real estate owner, the idea occurred to them, you know, why should we build cheap housing uptown when we can just fill in the rivers and have more expensive housing right where everybody wants to be?
You've included a map of the area that was added. Doesn't it correspond almost exactly to the area that was flooded by Superstorm Sandy?
That's one of the most amazing things I found doing the research on this book. So Manhattan Island originally was 18 square miles, and now it's 24 square miles. And most of the extra square mileage was put in lower Manhattan. And pretty much all the major flooding from Sandy was on those six square miles of landfill. You know, water goes where it wants to go, landfill or not, engineering or not, and Sandy proved that.
Weren't immigrant families already complaining about how high the rents were in New York City by the early 1700s?
Yes, by the 1700s, already immigrants find it's really hard to find affordable housing, and they complain bitterly about being gouged by landlords, even before there is such a thing as tenements.
So were they gravitating toward the surrounding areas, Brooklyn, Staten Island, Queens?
At that point, not so much.
The Bronx would have been pretty far away.
The Bronx is very far away. There are farms in Queens. There are farms in Brooklyn. But for the most part, if you're in a trade, if you're a merchant, you needed to be in lower Manhattan. And that's why the real estate prices and the rents got so high.
And New York City's population nearly doubled between 1756 and 1776, increasing from 13,000 to 25,000. That's just in the lead up to the war. Was there any connection?
There's a big connection between the lead up to the Revolutionary War and the increase in the population of New York. I mean, the political upheaval that brought about the Revolutionary War goes on over a decade. And people in Europe become nervous. They all aspire, many of them aspire to come to America because they hear it's this land where they can do so well. And they fear that the hostility between the British and the Americans is going to cut off the possibility. So they flood into New York in the years right before the Revolution, wanting to get in before it's too late.
Were they attracted mainly by the chance for upward mobility? Wasn't household income in New York City at that time 50% higher than in England, Ireland, and Scotland?
Yes, it's the upward mobility that attracts most of the immigrants, even though we often think of it as religious liberty that they come for.
And then Alexander Hamilton is one of the immigrants. He arrives in 1773, but he's coming from the Caribbean.
Yes, a huge number of people come from the Caribbean to New York. Not Caribbean natives necessarily, though Hamilton is, but people of British ancestry whose parents or grandparents had settled in the Caribbean, hoped to strike it rich as plantation owners, found they couldn't do so, but had traded with New York and decided that was the place to go.
And you include a mini biography of him and some other famous people who came here. In the case of Hamilton, did you start working on it before he became the subject of a hit musical?
Yes, well before. So on the one hand, I was happy that the Hamilton musical came along because it kind of makes people even more anxious to learn more about Hamilton, which they can do in my book.
And you also give us many biographies of John Jacob Astor, the Steinway brothers, the poet Pasquale D'Angelo, fashion designer Oscar de la Renta, and many others. And we'll take a little break and come back to the continuing history that you write about here in this book called City of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrant New York. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And my guest is Tyler Anbinder, who is a professor of history at George Washington University. And we are back with Tyler Anbinder, professor of history at George Washington University. He's the author of a number of books, including 5 Points, The 19th Century New York City Neighborhood That Invented Tap Dancing, Stole Elections, and Became the World's Most Notorious Slum, and also Nativism and Slavery, The Northern Know-Nothings and the Politics of the 1850s. His most recent, the one we are discussing, is City of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrants of immigrant New York, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. During the 1800s, wasn't New York City transformed by huge waves of immigrants coming from Ireland and Germany and Eastern Europe?
Absolutely. First from Ireland in particular, and that, of course, peaked with the potato famine in the 1840s and 50s, and then from Germany, especially in the 1840s and 50s, and then eventually from Eastern Europe and Italy as well in the late 19th century.
Were most of those immigrants discriminated against at first?
Absolutely. You know, one of the consistent things you find in New York's immigration history is there's virtually no immigrant group that wasn't discriminated against in some way. Maybe the English, after the English took over, maybe they avoided that. But every other group has come in for some form of discrimination. The Irish in particular, most famously in the area of jobs, where, you know, you find help wanted ads in the New York newspapers that say no Irish need apply. And that was something that both women in domestic service and men in other kinds of work would suffer.
And then French, Dutch, Swedish, Danish, Spanish, West Indian immigrants all coming in as well. What happened to the city's population? Obviously, couldn't just remain below Wall Street.
No. So the city expands tremendously, and immigrants take advantage of that. John Jacob Astor is a German immigrant who comes to the United States right after the American Revolution, and he begins as a musical instrument seller, and then he diversifies into furs. But he looks at the geography and he says, there's only one place for these people to go, and that's uptown. And so he buys much of what becomes Midtown Manhattan, you know, decades before there's any thought that anybody could live there. And then towards the end of his life, he becomes, you know, the richest man in America because of how much that real estate has increased in value.
He had no idea that there was schist underneath that would allow for the building of skyscrapers.
No, it was just the sense that people had to move uptown. There was no other direction to go, and this would be where the newest immigrants would live.
One of the people you profile here is Annie Moore, a 17-year-old Irish girl, the first immigrant processed in 1891 on Ellis Island. But that was a different Ellis Island building than the one that's there now?
Yes, the original, the iconic Ellis Island building that we know now was built about a decade after it opened. They started out on the cheap. They thought these are immigrants. They're kind of Europe's riffraff. Why should we spend too much money on them? So they built a cheap wooden structure, a pine structure. And from the very beginning, the Ellis Island people knew it was a fire trap. And sure enough, a few years after it opened, the whole thing caught on fire and burned to the ground. And luckily, the people who ran it so understood what a fire trap it was that they kept ferries stationed there with the steam up all night, every night, knowing that in case there was a fire, there'd be a ship ready to take them off before the place burned down.
But then they built a real building, a stone building.
They built a stone brick and marble building that we know today, and it actually was a prize-winning building. It won international prizes for the architecture.
Well, you can go there even now, and it's quite a wonderful building. Over the next 62 years, didn't some 15 million immigrants enter the country through Ellis Island?
Yes, Ellis Island becomes the place that not just New York's immigrants, but the entire nation's immigrants pour through and go through the screening process that becomes familiar to so many Americans through their ancestors.
Do you have any idea how many stayed and settled here?
In New York?
Yeah.
More immigrants settle in New York City than any other place. So it would not be too big a number to say maybe 10% of all the immigrants who come through Ellis Island are going to have spent some time living in New York City.
And I read somewhere that 1 in 7 families in America can trace at least some immigrant ancestor to Brooklyn.
That is true. That is true. Brooklyn becomes a place, especially after World War I, when the immigrants start to become more affluent, that New York's immigrants who to that point had lived mostly in Manhattan begin flooding into the new neighborhoods in Brownsville and East New York and all over Brooklyn.
We often read that officials changed or shortened immigrants' foreign-sounding names as they passed through Ellis Island. It's led to a Jewish joke about Jews named Ferguson. I don't know if you've heard that joke.
I haven't.
Supposedly, people said, I've forgotten, because they didn't understand the question. So the Irish guy at Ellis Island wrote Ferguson.
It's actually a myth, the idea that people's names were changed at Ellis Island. When you got processed at Ellis Island, you actually didn't leave with any piece of paper at all. So there was nothing telling you what your name was or anything else. And in fact, the inspectors only had 1 minute per family for inspection, and they had to ask 30 questions required by law. So there was no time to change anyone's name.
So there was pretty much anyone could get in except for convicts and Chinese people.
Pretty much.
The law, there was an exclusionary law that prevented the Chinese from coming in?
Right. Starting in 1882, even though Americans had always been wary of immigrants, even those from Europe, the Chinese to them, to native-born Americans, seemed to pose an extra menace, both in part because they seemed too foreign, incapable of becoming Americans, and in some cases because Americans feared that the Chinese worked too hard, that they would be too much competition for them. And so for those reasons and racism and so forth, the Chinese are excluded altogether starting in 1882.
And then what about people who were ill? Were they concerned about syphilis and gonorrhea? Even though syphilis and gonorrhea, as I understand it, began in the Americas and were spread to Europe by colonists who came here and went back to Europe.
That is absolutely true. Yes, so there are a number of diseases that inspectors would look for at Ellis Island. For most of them, if they were curable diseases, you could go to the hospital at Ellis Island, and once you were better, you were let into the country. But there were a couple of things that were incurable, there was an eye ailment called trachoma that was very contagious, but before antibiotics was not curable. And if you had that, you were sent back to Europe or wherever you had come from.
During the early 1900s, in the years leading up to World War I, most of New York City's new immigrants were Italian, many of the immigrants from other countries, like them, were criticized for being excessively violent, failing to assimilate, and also accused of being genetically inferior. But we're hearing some of the same things again today.
Yes, there's pretty much no criticism of immigrants today that hasn't been leveled at the previous waves of immigrants. And so you get pretty much the exact same criticisms that they don't assimilate, that they don't learn English, that they depend too much on government handouts, that they're especially criminal, that they're especially violent, and even that they pose a national security risk. The Italians there were lots of Italian terrorists in the United States, and some of the worst examples of terrorism in American history before 9/11 were perpetrated by Italian immigrants. The most famous example was the Wall Street bombing of 1920, when nearly 40 people were killed on the street and hundreds wounded with a huge bomb that was detonated right outside the J.P. Morgan Bank headquarters.
Sacco and Vanzetti, the anarchists, became emblems of that.
Exactly. Sacco and Vanzetti were actually, it's believed, the inspiration for the Wall Street bombers. Their imprisonment supposedly inspired the New York anarchists to go on their spree of bombings.
So this is when Congress starts enacting laws like the Emergency Quota Act?
Yes. So starting in 1921 and then furthermore in 1924, Congress imposes the first ever large-scale restrictions on immigration. But the restrictions were very targeted. So English immigrants, Irish immigrants could pretty much continue to come to the United States in unlimited numbers. But if you were Italian, East European Jewish, Greek, the number of immigrants from those places was cut by over 90%.
And that was the National Origins Act that you're referring to in 1924, signed by Calvin Coolidge. Didn't that remain in effect until 1965?
Correct. So we had this national origin system, and the idea of the national origin system was that we should only let in immigrants in the proportion that they were already represented in the American population, so that immigration would not change the American population's ethnic background one iota. And that was the system that was in place from 1924 until 1965. And it's changed in 1965 primarily because the children and grandchildren of those immigrant groups that were discriminated against under the Act, the Italian Americans, Polish Americans, Eastern European Jewish Americans, began to get enough political clout in Congress to be able to overturn the law.
Didn't the shortage of new immigrants to fill low-wage jobs in New York City during the 20s and 30s open opportunity for African Americans who wanted to escape the Jim Crow South?
It did. And so that's the period of the Great Migration of African Americans from the South to the North. And large numbers come to New York City. And when you look at what they say about why they've come to New York, they specifically cite the fact that immigration has been curtailed. So a lot of African Americans were very supportive of the immigration restrictions because they said now jobs are opened up to us that have been out of our reach before.
But they also experienced Jim Crow laws right here in New York. We talked recently with another guest about a woman who insisted on riding in a trolley that was reserved only for white people.
Right. The African Americans were disappointed to find that a lot of the racism that they thought they had left behind in the South was existent in New York as well. And that was something that they were very bitter about.
Did illegal immigration become a problem in the United States immediately after the Emergency Quota Act was enacted in 1921?
Well, it's a judgment to say whether it became a problem, but what you can definitely say is that illegal immigration became very large. So right after those restrictive laws were passed, you have the people who want to come to the United States, especially to join their relatives who they can't now join. They come to the United States anyway, and they'll go to Canada or to Cuba, and then from there they'll find ways to get smuggled into the United States. And so you have a huge number of tens, hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants coming to the United States in the 1920s, into the millions by the end of the decade, and they're mostly Italians and mostly East European Jews.
How many of the 2,600 people who were killed on 9/11 were immigrants?
Just about proportionate to their population, their percentage of the population in New York, so about a third.
And yet the hijackers all had visas. They were here legally.
The hijackers were here legally, not as immigrants, though. That's important to realize, because some people tend to think, oh, well, they came in via the immigration route. But no, their visas were as either tourist visas or student visas, and so none of them were pretending to be immigrants.
You describe how Muslim immigrants have been singled out by the federal government and by New York City since 9/11.
Well, I guess the way I characterize it is they've gotten an especially large amount of surveillance from the government right after 9/11. It was the FBI and the New York City Police Department both institute programs to watch people from countries that they believed were likely to bring about terrorism. And that devastates the Pakistani immigrant community and other Muslim immigrant communities in New York, where people feel like, and they're not imagining this, that they are constantly being watched and constantly being listened to.
Aren't all male Muslim non-citizens over 16 years old required to report to immigration and naturalization to be fingerprinted, photographed, and questioned.
That was what happened after 9/11, exactly, that was put in place, a means of literally keeping track of and watching all Muslims from certain countries. So a Muslim from France wouldn't necessarily be watched, but a Muslim from someplace in South Asia or the Middle East, absolutely.
Now, New York didn't have much of a Mexican population until maybe 30 years ago. And many of the people in this case came from Puebla, not an area that has sent immigrants to other parts of the United States.
That's right. New York has had historically a low Mexican immigrant population compared to other parts of the United States. I think that's in part because New York has had such a large Puerto Rican population and then a large Dominican population. And so Mexicans felt like there wasn't as much opportunity here as there was for them in other places. But eventually, Mexican immigrants started coming in large numbers to New York. And yes, in particular from the state of Puebla, which is south-southeast of Mexico City. But that's continuing a trend you have with other immigrant groups. There have always been, you know, for the Irish, for example, immigrants from Cork particularly came to New York. And from Italy, from people from Sicily especially came from New York. So it's not unusual to have one region of a country send a large number of people to the city.
Often because the shops that develop in the areas that people settle in specialize in the foods of that area.
Yes, the shops will specialize in the food of the people who come to that area, and so people from those places will feel comfortable. But there's also the networking involved, where you'll say to your relative or your friend, if you come to New York, I can hook you up with a job at the construction site I work at or at the nail salon I work at, and in that way you also get this chain migration from one place to another, ending in New York.
Today, 3.2 million of New York City's 8.5 million residents, 37% are immigrants. The second largest immigrant groups are the Dominicans and the Chinese. And you've said that they rarely live in the same areas of the city. Is there a reason for that?
Yes and no, in the sense that we know that immigrants tend to kind of cluster. And because the Chinese and the Dominicans are such large immigrant groups, there tends not to be room for both of them in one neighborhood.
The Chinese used to go to Manhattan's Chinatown. Now the Queens Chinatown, the Brooklyn Chinatown are growing. And you also point out that many are leaving the city.
Absolutely. A lot of immigrants now are choosing to, like other Americans, go to the suburbs where they believe there are better schools for their kids, more room, more fresh air. And so immigrants follow, move for the same reason that other Americans do.
Should we be surprised by some of the groups that are fairly large? The Ecuadorians make up the sixth largest immigrant group in New York City. I'm not sure that many people are aware of that. The Guyanese are the second largest immigrant group in Queens and the fifth largest in New York City overall.
Right. So if you live in Queens, you probably know about the Guyanese community, which is one of the biggest immigrant groups in all of New York and has been for some time. And most New Yorkers probably couldn't even find Guyana on a map. Guyana is this small state in the northern tip of South America. You know, probably most famous for Jim Jones's settlement there and the mass suicide. But yes, huge numbers of Guyanese have come to New York. They're especially hard to notice because the Guyanese, they don't all, some of them don't look like they come from the West Indies region. They look ethnically Indian because Guyana had a huge population of Indians settled there to harvest cotton in the 19th century, and their descendants are the ones who are often coming to New York.
Well, two separate groups are coming, many African people of African descent and many from Indian descent, but none of the northern South American indigenous people.
Not so much, no.
Staten Island has the smallest number of immigrants of the five boroughs, but isn't the immigrant population there now growing at a faster rate than any of the other boroughs?
Yes, the proportion of the population of Staten Island that is immigrant is growing faster than that in any other borough. It's in particular there are immigrants there from Mexico, but also from Africa and from Sri Lanka has a large population in Staten Island.
So what do you see as the trend? Brooklyn is now one of the most expensive areas in the country. Are we going to see fewer immigrants going there?
I don't think so, because if you look at the map of Brooklyn, the kind of the northwest part of Brooklyn, which is kind of the fashionable hipster area, Cobble Hill and whatnot, that has very few immigrants in it. Whereas if you look at central Brooklyn and south Brooklyn, there's huge immigrant populations. You know, I went recently to the areas where my Anbinder ancestors lived in Brownsville and East New York. And that area is predominantly West Indian immigrants. So I don't think that will change, but I think those hip areas of Brooklyn are going to be too pricey for immigrants.
Bay Ridge has tons of immigrants, but I have to correct you on Cobble Hill. If you go there, you're going to hear an awful lot of people speaking either with British accents or speaking in French. So
that
it's just
true.
Different kinds of immigrants move to different kinds of neighborhoods.
That is true.
Meanwhile, we have this fascinating book by Tyler Anbinder called City of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrant New York, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much. It's been a great privilege.